Hello, I'm Matt Baume, and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. We're on a podcast search for the entertainment that's changed the lives of queer people. My guest this week is John Griffiths, the founder and executive director of GALECA. That's the Society of LGBTQ Entertainment Critics. From an early age, John loved spending time with TV families. And as an adult, he turned that passion into a career, spending time hobnobbing and covering icons of entertainment. But like those found families that captured his attention as a kid, he's also assembled a family of his own, one consisting of hundreds of like-minded queer journalists and cultural critics. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, a couple quick reminders, starting with a heads up that I hope you'll join me for a weekly live stream over on Twitch. Every Sunday afternoon, we watch and talk about classic episodes of television, great movies, and occasionally old commercials out of a way of sticking with you. That's every Sunday at noon over at twitch.tv/MattBaume. And on my YouTube channel, I've got a video coming your way about the behind-the-scenes story of the movie Some Like It Hot, including the incredible backstage drama that threatened to tear many of the lead actors apart. That's coming your way soon at youtube.com/MattBaume. And if you haven't yet, take a look at my new book about the history of queer characters on sitcoms, Hi Honey, I'm Homo. It's available now wherever books are sold. It's the book that Dan Savage called a triumph and said everyone should read this book. So you should. Go to gaysitcoms.com to get a copy and request a personalized signature. Big thanks to everybody who makes all my work possible on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/MattBaume to support The Sewers of Paris and get patron-exclusive benefits. Now, here's my conversation with John. Well, this week I'm speaking with John Griffiths, the founder and executive director of GALECA and longtime entertainment journalist. John, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Matt, for having me. It is quite an honor. As a fellow TV nut, I am just so amazed by, you know, everything you do, and with such a smartness and cleverness and passion for history, which is what, you know, we kind of, we need to, history, even when it comes to entertainment, is super important these days.
Well, thanks so much. I really appreciate it. Glad you're a fan, and I'm a fan of all the work that you do too. So happy that we can make this happen.
Thank you.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
I would say just in general, first of all, TV, the TV set, you know, which introduced me to this whole parallel universe of shows that did, you know, impact me in a big way. I have to give a shout out. Okay, I'm just going to say The Big Valley is the TV show that that really became like a version of a Trekkie, except not Star Trek. I don't know what you would call somebody that is super passionate about a Western with Barbara Stanwyck and Lee Majors and Peter Breck and Linda Evans and Richard Long. It ran on ABC from 1965 to 1969. I'm not into Westerns, never was. I think they're boring in general, but the writing and the storyline just got to me as an adolescent, probably like around when I was 12 years old, in reruns. You know, TV, you know, going back to what I was saying just a second ago, TV itself was my best friend. I was about 5 years old when my mom decided to, she had been divorced from my dad and left him when she was pregnant with him. So I didn't really know my dad growing up. So it was just the two of us, and I was very spoiled. I was an only child, and I had a grandmother who was like, you know, my Auntie Mame, and very doted on by my grandmother in particular, less so my mom at the time. So my mom was kind of distant and not neglectful, but emotionally detached, a little bit like Mary Tyler Moore in Ordinary People.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But not as waspy, I should say that. She, you know, she wasn't as uptight. My mom is much more ethereal and kind of a romantic, but, you know, in many ways, literally and figuratively, way over there. So TV became sort of my, not pacifier, but that was my entry to the, you know, to friendships and seeing what parents were supposedly really like, which was not really necessarily the case. But, you know, a dream world and, you know, the Brady Bunch, of course, and Room 222 and the Partridge Family. Those were shows that I just would get lost in and go, oh my God, wouldn't it be great to live in that house? What a cool house. Because where I was growing up, it was very, at age five, when my mom met this guy, Nicholas, he had been married himself and he was very Catholic, and with his previous wife had eight children. So I moved from this very kind of, very idyllic, just me, world. I like to say I was kind of like Stewie on Family Guy, you know, very, very precocious, maybe, you know, or at least I thought I was brighter than most kids. I thought I was nicer than most kids. Like, why are you beating up that kid over there? That's not nice. Why are people mean? And probably another reason why I retreated to TV, where it seemed like people were nice unless they were criminals and everybody loved each other. Mm-hmm. But meanwhile, I was, you know, 5 years old, suddenly living in the San Fernando Valley's Van Nuys, California, which in the 70s, you know, it's a little bit storied. The Valley in the 70s has been, you know, the subject of movies and documentaries and stuff. Van Nuys was sort of the armpit of the Valley. And I grew up in this with these eight kids. My stepfather's wife had gone off to kind of go find herself and decided when my mom and Nicholas were, you know, because they were in love and they wanted to be together, she sort of graciously bowed out in a way. I mean, maybe she was tired of, you know, like having eight kids would be very overwhelming. She was a nice lady, but she, you know, took the opportunity to skedaddle. So my mom and I moved in with this these eight kids in this clapboard house built in 1909 with dogs pooping on the floors and you know, every time it rained, everybody would put up pots and pans to capture the water. You know, it was just for this little Lord Fauntleroy, very unsettling. So I, again, was drawn to, you know, my own little black and white TV with the click clunk channel switcher at the end of my bed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not only, you know, the standard sort of, you know, popular sitcoms of the day, but my little Stewie brain decided, oh, I like the television shows that get canceled. They're so smart. The first show I remember being very upset that was canceled was My World and Welcome to It. It starred William Wyndham, a great character actor, as it was inspired by James Thurber's sort of Walter Mitty-esque life. Mm-hmm. And his stories. And James and William Wyndham played this husband who was so like thrown by the world, and his sort of, this was not, you know, this was before feminism really hit, but his pesty wife, it won an Emmy for best sitcom or comedy series that year. And it was very clever and had all sorts of visual gags. He imagined his wife cracking up literally, mm-hmm. and she fell to pieces, like her image fell to pieces on the floor. And he said, oh, pull yourself together. You know, sort of stuff like that, that and get smart. And I thought, oh, I understand the stuff adults understand in these shows. I'm not just following, you know, the caper. I'm getting the, you know, cheeky inside jokes. And so that's the kind of kid I was, probably insufferable. yeah, it became this thing where my favorite shows were like about, you know, women, maybe like the Maritella Moore show, sure, but Diana, with Diana Rigg as this, you know, she played this British fashion expert or fashion magazine editor living in New York. And I thought she was so charming, and look at that world she's living in. That was something I really, you know, found super charming as a little, you know, soon to be gay kid. God, that, you know, through the years, like there was a show called Friends, about just that they were just six friends. I think Jill Whelan was one of the kids. They all lived on the same block or in the same neighborhood. They were just these really nice kids that were supportive of each other and good friends. Mm-hmm. And it was an hour-long Sunday night show that Aaron Spelling produced ahead of probably in his sort of quality wheelhouse, like Family, the great drama, not in the TNA section like Charlie's Angels. And very disappointed that was canceled. The White Shadow with Ken Howard is a, you know, a white coach who takes a job, quote, inner city. Great writing. It was an MTM show. Joan Pringle played his the assistant principal or principal, and she was great. It was sort of like Room 222, but an hour long. And dealt with some, you know, really strong issues and, you know, that were sort of universal for teens. That lasted just like about 2 years. CBS didn't know what to do with it. They bounce it all over the schedule, even though it got good ratings initially. Anyway, I just was drawn to series that were sort of underdogs, with characters that were sort of underdogs. And, you know, I made a note here because a lot of the shows that, and movies too, that this little gay kid was drawn to were about, you know, that the themes were injustice and people sort of out to get you. And I think that that was, you know, just being very, just being upset that I was growing up in this world more and more as I realized that not only were kids mean, but society was mean because, you know, I was gay and I knew that that was totally fine. I had no problem with it. But, oh, my God, look at this world and how awful it is and how our people are treated. So, yeah, I think subconsciously I needed these kind of shows to kind of confirm that there is goodness in the world and justice and love and truth will win out. And meanwhile, you know, it's sort of exciting to be, you know, to look at, you know, stories of people that are, you know, being, you know, pursued or prosecuted or wrongly accused. And that all goes back to, as they say, I'm a bit all over the map here, but the Big Valley, you know, like I said, I wasn't into Westerns. So yeah, you know, here I am in this house that is very, you know, the Royal Tannenbaums or Running with Scissors meets Tobacco Road, if you will. There was a lot of love there, but I still felt different. And the kids were wild and I wasn't. You know, I was a little sheltered and pampered. I didn't relate to the kids necessarily. Two of my step siblings that were around my age, most everybody was older except for Regina and Christian. And we had fun, we connected and really loving good kids. But, you know, there was a lot of screaming and running around and holes being punched in the wall, you know, because during arguments or for me, it was with my mom not quite around, you know, like at the other end of the house, kind of doing her own thing with my stepfather. We were kind of left to run footloose and fancy free. I don't know how to put it anyway. So I came across in reruns amid all this, you know, the Get Smarts, the I Love Lucy, which I loved and the Mothers-in-Law and, Green Acres, Family Affair, all these shows that everybody sort of connects to in some way from that era in reruns. You know, I really hated Bonanza. I didn't like Gunsmoke. I was, you know, I'm not into this sort of, the dull Western odor, as they say, was not for me.
You mentioned that you were coming to a realization that you were a little gay kid and you were totally fine with that, which I imagine in the late 60s, early 70s might have been a difficult process. It sounds like it was relatively smooth for you. And I know that it wasn't for a lot of people. So what do you attribute that to? It sounds like you managed to dodge a lot of the angst and the self-recrimination and all the you know, maybe not all of it, but it sounds like it was smoother than it could have been.
Well, you know, no, actually it was terrible. For me personally, I knew it was okay, but my anger mm-hmm. and frustration towards society for, you know, saying it's not okay, made me very cynical and very, you know, determined to, you know, at least I didn't come out until I was 25. And then it was pretty, you know, step by step with, you know, one person and one person. And
how did you know that it was okay? Were there people or figures in your life that made it, you know, that presented it as something you didn't have to be so uptight about?
No, to the contrary. I just knew it was me. I you know, there were images on TV that were, you know, quote, flaming characters and that would, you know, make me cringe and uncomfortable. And I did have internalized homophobia to some extent. I, for sure, I didn't want anybody to know I was one of those people. But I was. It was this sort of duality where I knew deep in my heart that it was fine because it was all I could be. It hit me like a ton of bricks in seventh grade. I, you know, went from fooling around with a neighborhood girl and not knowing what that meant, it was just a physical pleasure, to suddenly the chemistry. I saw a guy in the seventh grade in the locker room, shirtless with the nicely placed hair, the hairway to heaven or whatever. And I was like, oh my God. And it just hit me. I'm like, oh my God, I'm gay. This is really bad. This is terrible. It just on a superficial level, because I'm like, I have to keep this quiet. But at the same time, I had total confidence that it was no big deal, because how could I be anything other than that? It wasn't like there was no moral issue with me. That was like, it's just that society doesn't get it. And so because society is stupid, I am going to, I guess, live a lie the rest of my life, because I still want to have a nice life. At one point, I even thought, well, I'm just going to marry a lesbian. So I placed an ad in LA, in the LA Weekly, when they had personal ads back in the day. and basically, a gay guy seeking a lesbian to live a lie together in this horrible world. So
did you get any answers?
I got one.
How'd it go?
I met this woman at a restaurant. It was so obvious that, neither of us were going to fool anybody. And, I was just like, okay, this is silly. This is not going to work, because, she was not a lipstick lesbian. Let me just say that. Sorry about that. So I realized, well, that's silly. So I threw in the towel there, and I, continued to sort of live a lie. And then at one point, I just realized I can't do this anymore. This is stupid. And I came out and to a friend, and then another friend, and then another friend. But it was a long process. In high school, I tried to kill myself over, I was in love with my best friend who was straight, and wound up becoming best man at his wedding, and kept quiet even through that. And finally, when I did come out to him, he was upset, and we're not friends anymore. So he kind of proved my theory, or my guesstimate of what might happen. At the same time, in his defense, he felt, maybe rightly, that I wasn't honest with him for years. These are the things that, growing up, even today, I could write it off as Orange County. That's where I went to high school, ultimately. It was very conservative back then, but we live in a world now where, there are people with YouTube channels that speak about how, that are brands with books and celebrity guests talking about how they're not gay anymore because they found Jesus and Jesus is their new love, and how the gays, quote unquote, are going to burn in hell, basically.
Was there a breaking point for you? You said, I think it was around 25 that you came out. Was there a point where you were like, this is the thing that has convinced me I need to stop living this lie?
I had good friends, and I knew that they didn't care. And I just had this, sort of tipsy moment with a friend. I was getting tired maybe of the spying and the lying and living in fear that I was going to get caught. I realized that I had friends around me that wouldn't care. And my friend Jennifer, she said at a party, I said, there's something that I have to tell you that might end our friendship. And she said, what? Are you dying? What's wrong? And I said, God, well, it's hard for me to say. And she said, are you gay? And I said, no, I'm bi.
Sure.
And I don't discount, bisexuality by any means. But for me, that was a way of keeping a toe in what I thought would be masculinity at the time. But then, soon enough, it's like, yeah, I'm just gay. I'm gay. And told more people, and everybody pretty much, was like happy for me, and except for that one friend. And, it's funny because I am so not the person I thought I would, sure. Like back then. I mean, it's so silly I would just encourage people to, well, everybody has their own journey. I shouldn't give any advice on when to come out or if to come out, but it worked out for me, and I wish I had done it much earlier.
Had you ever seen coming out before? Like, did you have any model for doing that at all?
No, but again, back to the Big Valley. The first episode, Lee Majors plays this sort of lost lonely, forlorn guy named Heath, who comes to the rich Barclay family, headed up by matriarch and widow Victoria Barclay, whose husband Tom is dead, has been dead. And she has three sons and a daughter, played by Linda Evans. And he comes into their world to say that he is Tom Barclay's bastard son. And they are just very upset about this. It really, you know, they don't believe him. He is treated quite poorly. Linda Evans' character, Audra, hits on him to kind of suss it out to see if he's telling the truth. And which is kind of kinky if you think about it for 1965 television. But they ultimately grow to love him. They find out it's true that Tom Barclay, Victoria, Barbara Stanwyck's wife, husband, had an affair and really loved her. In a letter, he stated that the whole thing, it was a weak moment, you know. And then Lee Major's character, for, you know, throughout the first season especially, you know, bumps into mean people who knock him for, you know, being a bastard son, that he's not really a Barclay, and the family stands up for him over and over, and but he has to deal with his what was a secret but coming out, you know, as you know, he wanted to stake his claim for what was his. And I think that's what people do when they're when they come out. They're not just, you know, admitting something. It's not that. It's saying who they are. They're staking a claim, finally, at last, for what is rightfully theirs. You know, having a good life, you know, a fair life, you know, treated just like everybody else, you know, for good or bad, depending on what you do with your life, how you choose to do things. You know, that and with Barbara Stanwyck being such a strong, loving mother to him and calling him her mother, I mean, his mother, and being such a strong moral compass throughout the show, is really well written for a Western. You know, it just she became like a surrogate mom to me. I'm like, oh, God, that's what I wish my mom were like, you know, firm and strong and loving and a sense of humor. And that's why The Big Valley, outside of its, you know, a very well-produced show, still very popular, by the way, and reruns on different channels, you know, different cable channels.
So you would have been coming out, was this like the mid-70s or so? Like, and where was this? Were you still in like the LA area?
I came out not until, I was in Los Angeles. I was born in Los Angeles and lived for that time in the Valley, before that in fancy Hancock Park, before my mom met that guy with the eight kids. I went to USC, still in the closet, after living down in Newport Beach in high school, where I was in the closet. And then I lived in LA, and it wasn't until 1990. Let's see, I was, I was born in, I'm 60 in October. So how old does that make me in 19, like when I was 25, that's when I came out. So like the late 80s, early 90s is when I started to come out.
Okay.
Then I didn't come out to my mom until 1995.
What was that world like when you're first coming out of the closet, late 80s, early 90s, Los Angeles? What was the scene like? How were you discovering other queer people and what, you know, options were open to you as a gay man?
Oh, you know, like in first years of college, I was, you know, having nookie on the beach. You know, I found, cruising places and even down in Laguna Beach in Orange County. And then up in LA, during college, I would kind of poke around, just happened to walk by the Gay and Lesbian Student Union to see, you know, what was happening there, but not go in. And then I would, you know, cruise. I knew about West Hollywood, so I would drive around, Rage. And,
sure, yeah.
You know, the Motherlode at the time, and Trunks. And every blue moon, I did have a fake ID. So I every blue moon, I would pop in. And I didn't really love it. It wasn't quite my scene. But, you know, I did make some friends. Down in Orange County, there was a place called the Newport Station that had a gay club like one night a week. And I met some people there. But it was a very scary, weird time for me because I was, you know, having fun and you know, doing drugs and making friends and coming out of, you know, my sort of, for lack of a better word, mothballs, you know, like I was not sheltered, but I just was a lonely kid that moved around a lot. And you know, it was hard to make friends when I did. So, you know, that added to my sort of feeling of otherness. So in college, when I, you know, I did a lot of drugs and afterwards and made a lot of friends. So,
and you said you came out to your mother kind of in the middle of the 90s there. I imagine that was probably not easy to do.
No, you know, I fell in love with, I became infatuated with this Christian Slater lookalike who was, we dated for like about a month, but he was just the bad boy that everybody, you know, fantasizes about, you know, from a movie. He drove up like a beat up El Camino and you know, just knew all the cool people and was uncomfortable with being gay himself at the time. He was like catnip. I was just like, oh my God, he was cinematic and did things that were just really wild. He said at one point, I can't handle this man about dating, which made me even crazier about him. I was so besotted and sad and I called my mom because, you know, she is my mom. It just came up. I just said, I was just crying. And I said, I'm so sad and I'm in love and I don't know what to do. And I said, there's something I need to tell you. And she said, well, there's nothing that would ever make me stop loving you. And she really kind of, you know, stepped up. And I said, well, I'm gay. And, I'm gay. And she said, oh, well, is that all? There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, there's nothing you can do about that from what I've heard. And it just sounds like you're in romantic love, which can be very misleading. And it's not real love. You want somebody that is a teammate, a companion. And she really, you know, yeah, again, it kind of blew me away. I saw her in a different light. And I think it's because she went through that herself. And it turns out years later, I found out her best friend was gay. She never had an interest in him, but you know, she didn't care, you know, that I don't know why I thought she would, but she didn't.
And were you studying entertainment industry stuff or journalism? Like, how did you start to get into that field?
I always wanted to be a TV network programmer, like a Fred Silverman. I don't know if your listeners know who that is, but you probably do. I'm sure you do.
Oh, sure. Yeah. The man with the golden gut.
Yeah. So I just was fascinated, but because of the Big Valley, that I wanted to know everything about that show and wound up, I don't know where I found it, like in college, maybe even sooner, you know, Variety Archives or at the library, I printed out stuff about Big Valley being canceled and low ratings and programming and, you know, the time slots. And all of that made me fascinated in just the business itself. Like, what makes a show a hit? You know, as I said before, I was already fascinated by, you know, shows that got canceled, you know, too quickly. And so I thought, I want to be the guy that puts, you know, decides what goes on the air. And I would, you know, pick really great shows. I have friends that do that now. And it turns out their job is so stressful. I wouldn't even want half of what they do. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, especially today. But yeah, so that's that got me to study entertainment journalism or just journalism at USC. And with the thinking I would become somehow, you know, they even had a class in network programming. And I thought maybe that would lead me, you know, going to USC with contacts, whatever, you know, was in my mind. But I wound up starting with a couple of people, a campus magazine that went all over Southern California, excuse me, ultimately, that was kind of a throwaway wannabe interview. And my interest in TV and film led me to, you know, do cover stories on Keanu Reeves before he really made it. Right around the time he did The River's Edge.
Oh, sure.
Chris Isaac, and I did stories on Saturday Night Live and even a show, an article about a show that I loved that was canceled too quick called Quark, which was a Star Trek spoof by Buck Henry. You can see
Wow, I've never heard of that.
it's really funny. Richard Benjamin plays the captain of a spaceship
Oh,
that collects.
yes, I do know this one. It's a trash collecting ship, right?
Yes, and the Doublemint twins play twins, and then there's a half man, half ficus, or half plant named Ficus, and then there's a Jean, who is one side of his body is a man, one side is a woman.
Yes, I recall. So I've seen the pilot, and I recall thinking that the idea of that character, who's sort of, I guess we would call them non-binary today, it is not quite as enlightened as we
No,
as a modern audience might expect.
not at all. I mean, it was pretty much, it was, just meant to be obviously like a crazy spoof with not much interest and sensitivity, but at the same time, sort of maybe daring and clever, sort of the gray area maybe. But the series itself, it hit and miss, but some laugh out loud moments and Buck Henry. You can't go wrong with Buck Henry.
Very handsome man, star of oh gosh, what's the murder mystery that Stephen Sondheim did? I forgot. The Last of Sheila.
Oh yeah, right. Yeah, and Get Smart and Heaven Can Wait with Warren Beatty and Julie Christie. Just a god.
Yeah. Wow. So you're kind of getting yourself into journalism and being a self-starter, it sounds like, starting a magazine. That's not a small thing. It sounds
No.
like you're still kind of finding your place in the industry or your relationship to it.
Yeah, I just even now. But yeah, is I love doing that. I love the startup mentality and sort of like let's put on a show. And that's what got me to, the clips there, that experience got me to People Magazine, where I was a special correspondent for about 7 years, interviewed a lot of TV stars and movie stars, and from Queen Latifah, when she was just starting out, kind of, or was a more of a rap star, to, oh God, Brandon Lee, Bruce Lee's son, everybody from Married with Children. And then, interestingly, Melissa Etheridge and her first wife for the first couple story that was on an LGBTQ duo, and they were lovely. And Dick Sargent, I don't know if I think I was going to tell you the story. Dick Sargent, I interviewed at his house. He was just amazing. He was super sweet. It was when the National Enquirer had outed him and was saying, more than that was just coming up with lies and stuff. And he wanted to set the record straight. So he told me his life story. And during the chat, he said, oh, Elizabeth Montgomery is going to call. During the interview, I arranged for that. And I said, oh, that's great. So she did. And I got on the phone and I said, hey, so did you know he was gay and did you care? And she said, yes, we knew. And, we didn't care at all. It's just so silly. Let me ask you, John, are you gay? And I was in the closet, but I said, well, yeah. And Dick Sargent was listening on the other line, and I didn't know that. And he goes, "Well, I didn't know that." Then he told me I had a cute little upturned bunny nose. Oh no, not bunny nose. That's terrible. Button nose.
Button
Sorry.
nose. Oh, I mean, either one sounds cute, so I mean, that's high praise.
Yeah, and he was just a very, very nice guy, and talked about role models. I'm like, wow. This he it was his Laurel Canyon, I believe, home with a beautiful brick patio that he had laid with his husband who had passed away. And yeah, I was like, well, look at this. Dreams can come true.
Yeah, wow. What a like a lovely moment to have. Like my impression of him from interviews that I've read and watched is that he was just very gentle and thoughtful and just like kindness comes through in the way that he does an interview. So it's nice to hear that that was your experience.
Right. And I've interviewed closeted people and, they're uptight and uncomfortable. And I'm like, why are you even doing this interview? So I think that he felt free too. It was nice to see him, very happy.
Yeah. Wow. That's really remarkable. And I got to say, if like somebody told me that, oh, Elizabeth Montgomery is going to be calling in a minute, my heart would be in my throat.
Right. Yeah, because I loved her, you know. I thought she just seemed like a really nice person. And I just read recently Dominic Dunn's sort of memoirs about the 60s. And he was really good friends with her. He was a bit of a starshipper, as we all know. And I think it was because, you know, she was the daughter of Robert Montgomery and also a TV star. And he became very good friends with her. And he said that she dropped him just like that, and that for no reason. And he was very, you could tell he was hurt. He was a little bit more, But, you know, and I just wonder if you read between the lines, I kind of get the feeling that she dropped him because he wasn't that great of a guy.
Oh, well.
You know, but that's my take. Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like as part of your work and in journalism is, you know, taking the sensibility that you had as a kid or developed as a kid and your interest in shows about found families and blended families, you know, you're both exploring the people who bring those stories to life, but also, I mean, what greater found slash blended family is there than showbiz, particularly like either the dynasties, entertainment dynasties in Hollywood, or the I don't know, the way that a family develops among the cast and crew of a long running show. So I wonder to what extent your experience was, you know, documenting and seeking out and telling the stories of families in the same way that you were experiencing those stories as a kid watching television.
It is interesting. Through the years, you know, I've interviewed a lot of people, and for starters, you know, I became, you know, struck by how many people that became stars were roommates before they were stars with other people that became stars.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, Neil Patrick Harris and Ryan Reynolds, or I mean, the list is sort of endless. It's like, you know, maybe they're all narcissists and they realize that they need to glom onto the ones that are really going to rise because they can rise together. It's always good advice to give somebody that says they want to break into acting, you know, to tell them to find really good, you know, actors there in classes and that you think, wow, they're amazing, that you know, the teacher's pet, and just become buddies with them. You know, you go back to the method actors, that they were all just so close. And I read, like, what was it? Judy Carnes? Oh, no, Rhona Barrett, of all people. I don't know if anybody knows who that is anymore. She's still alive and has a big business where she helps the elderly, or a nonprofit. She was roommates with somebody super famous. And so she was friends with Warren Beatty and all these people before anybody ever became famous. And yeah, so it's just sort of, so they start with that family. And back in the, because of the, you know, my fascination with the Big Valley, I'm actually writing a book about it and interviewing a lot of stars from that era. And it was a small town in Hollywood, and everybody knew each other. They all went to the same three clubs, and they all dated each other. Yeah, so it is, and you spend this amount of, a certain amount of time with these people, you're going to like them or not like them. And, you know, the party line, of course, is that, you know, oh, we were all so close. But, you know, I've interviewed several friends, people through the years. And I don't mean on the phone, but like, not that I know them, but, you know, 2 hours, 3 hours at their home, or, you know, at a restaurant. And, you know, hearing stories from different journalists. You know, that's one example of you know, very close-knit group that, you know, with, you know, some that have had super struggles, they, you know, they do know the not great sides of each other too. And but then what's weird about these families is that they just all break up at
Sure,
some
yeah.
point, and, you know, form another little nucleus or whatever. And maybe that's like our real families, you know, as opposed to found families and you know, oppressed cultures. Yeah, it's odd. I have family that I'm not as close to as I am, you know, with my queer friends. And yeah, that's a whole other thing.
Well, you know, speaking of close families and journalists that you've worked with, you've basically done done it all over again. You've created another family with the critics organization that you started and that you run now. How did that wind up happening?
I was with some friends, and you know, I one morning I had this idea that you know, we all have ideas that we have the energy to execute or don't. But this one just popped into my mind, and I thought, you know, God, it would be really fun to have a group of queer critics give out awards on everything, because we have such a different sensibility, you know, born of oppression or whatever you want to call it, just, you know, maybe genetics. You know, we love camp, we love melodrama, we love, quote, fierce women, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so I thought it would be fun I checked it with some other friends that were journalists that were gay, and they said, yeah, that sounds great. So put together maybe about 20 journalists the first year, entertainment critics, TV and film critics, and people covering the mediums. And that was 14 years ago. And we gave out our first awards in 2010. Now we have over 500 members nationwide and in Canada, England, Australia, Mexico, Brazil. Yeah, it's and it is a family. It's very, you know, that's a lot of people, but I just think it's beautiful and important to celebrate the queer eye, not just on hair and makeup and gray clothes, but, you know, on movies and TV and, you know, maybe music someday. And we just added Broadway and off Broadway, a contingent there. You know, it's the world has obviously looked to our people as we're a great go-to for recommendations.
Sure. Yeah.
I don't know what it is. Maybe because we're, you know, we grew up feeling like me, sort of lonely and different, and TV and movies became my sort of, you know, world. That maybe we're a little bit more informed than some. I don't know. It's you can tell me, Matt.
You know, this is one of the big mysteries that I often am either asked about or find myself thinking about, is the stereotype of gay men in particular as very knowledgeable and kind of a great resource for finding entertainment. Why are we so embedded in both the industry and also just as fans and so expert in our fandom? I don't know. I don't know what that's about, but I think that's a good theory that we find ourselves very sensitively looking for either escape or representation or, you know, like you were, the families that felt like they would accept us. So,
and women too, and, you know, non-binary folk and mm-hmm. You know, transgender members in our group, you know, there are different communities in our community. Mm-hmm. And we have different points of view, and then we bring the individual interests and you know, favorite movies and stuff. But I think we can all agree that for whatever reason, we have a different take on things. And, you know, that again is, you know, could be a mix of, you know, growing up fearing that people are going to not love us. That might, you know, affect our take on things. It might, you know, pull us to certain types of stories and visuals. And then, you know, I think we are just different inherently. We are different people, and sexuality, our perspective in general is a little bit different. So, yeah, who knows? But I find it fascinating, and I think you can't deny it, you know.
So folks find their tastes aligned with yours. What are some recommendations for shows and movies that you would urge them to seek out?
Okay, yeah. Well, you know, Splendor in the Grass is in my top 10. That is with Natalie Wood and Warren Beatty. Natalie Wood is so hot for Warren Beatty and vice versa. And they're in 1920s, 30s, the Midwest. And they just want each other but can't, because they're good, you know, they're quote good kids. Mm-hmm. And their sexual yearnings are so strong that Natalie at one point, spoiler alert, has a breakdown, and I so related to that, by the way. And it has one of the saddest endings ever that is sort of philosophical about life, so maybe not that sad in the long run, sort of informative. And boy, did that get to me as, you know, a victim of unrequited love. Mm-hmm. And Earthquake, I can watch that movie over and over again. It's about how LA is hit with a big, gigantic whammy. It's melodramatic. It's over the top in some ways. It has a closeted gay character in the form of Marjo Gortner as a totally wackadoodle army guy who is, yeah. And yeah, it's directed by the guy that directed Valley of the Dolls, I believe. So yeah, don't quote me, but I'm pretty sure there. Anyway, that's it's just it's melodramatic, but it's just highly watchable, very entertaining, and I could watch it over and over. Anything with Barbara Stanwyck, Christmas in C Connecticut, Ball of Fire, No Man of Her Own, which is a sort of overlooked movie of hers, that is just speaks to me. And being in the closet, she plays a woman who is pregnant, and her baby daddy wants nothing to do with her. She's on a train. She meets this wonderful, sweet couple that have a baby coming along, and there's a train wreck. The nice couple is killed, and she's mistaken for the pregnant married woman, and is who's he was heading off to meet her rich family. And so she's like, okay, I'll be that person. And then she's found out here and there, and that it's just really well done. No Man of Her Own. Mame with Lucille Ball is, I think, an underrated, fun movie. Everybody blasted Lucille Ball for not having a great singing voice, but she's totally charming in the role anyway. It doesn't matter. People were really upset that Angela Lansbury didn't get to play the screen character version. So I think that's some of it. It's a little dated, but it's again highly watchable. I could watch that movie over and over. And I so related to, because my grandmother being sort of my MAME, I related to this orphan kid who is just thrown into this new world and makes a go of it and has fun. And I don't know if that's 10, but that's a pretty good,
Yeah, that's a good range. John, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Matt. I so appreciate it. I hope I made sense.
Thanks to John for joining me. Thanks to you for listening. And thanks to everybody who makes the Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/MattBaume to support the podcast and get backer rewards like weekly bonus videos and a care pack in the mail. Check out my new book, Hi Honey, I'm Homo, for a history of queer characters on American sitcoms. Visit my YouTube channel for stories from behind the scenes of iconic pop culture. And keep up with even more of my work through my weekly newsletter. You can find all that and more at mattbaume.com. The theme song for The Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.